When it comes to financial advice, you got to trust the source. It's why you listen to this podcast. When I'm looking to upgrade my wallet, I turn to NerdWallet. Their expert team of nerds dives into the details to help you find smarter financial products. Before NerdWallet, I'd pay for vacations with whatever was in my wallet, but I was missing out on miles I didn't even know I was leaving on the table. Now I've got a new card with more miles and more upgrades. What could future you do with more travel rewards? A hotel upgrade? Lounge access? Wherever you go next, make it happen with a smarter travel credit card. Don't wait to make smart financial decisions. Compare and find smarter credit cards, savings accounts, and more today at nerdwallet.com. NerdWallet, finance smarter. As with all cards, credit is subject to lender approval and terms apply. First, you probably know the bad news already. Mint has shut down. But here's the good news. There's a better alternative. Monarch Money. That's right. Mint users are turning to Monarch Money and loving it. As a finance nerd, you would assume that I have my money game all together. Well, shocker, I didn't. Until Monarch Money. Monarch Money allowed me to easily see what is going on with my finances, help me get a better handle on my spending, budgets, and more. It's my go-to app every day, more so than my bank, because I can quickly see where I am with my budgets and spending, allowing me to invest more and spend time on things I want to do. It's my GPS for money. Monarch is the top-rated all-in-one personal finance app. It gives you a comprehensive view of all your accounts, investments, transactions, and more. Create custom budgets, set goals, and collaborate with your partner. And now you get an extended 30-day free trial when you go to monarchmoney.com/beginners. Monarch has a tool that allows you to easily import your data from Mint and keep all your tags and categories. Monarch is the most customizable budgeting app. Change the layout of your dashboard, toggle between light and dark mode, create custom budgets and notifications, set up automatic rules for transactions and notifications, and more. Monarch is obsessed with constantly improving the product. They release updates every 2 weeks and allow customers to submit suggestions, vote on requested features, and view the product roadmap. In fact, Monarch Money is one of the first to bring you direct Apple Card, Apple Cash, and savings syncing with the latest iOS 17.4 update. Now you can sync your wallet directly for seamless budgeting. After trying out Monarch for myself, I understand why it's a top-rated personal finance app. And right now, get an extended 30-day free trial when you go to monarchmoney.com/beginners. That's monarchmoney.com/beginners for your extended 30-day free trial.
Love this podcast because it crushes your dreams of getting rich quick.
They actually got me into reading stats for anything.
You're tuned in to the Investing for Beginners podcast.
Led by Andrew Sather and Dave Ahern.
Step-by-step premium investing guidance for beginners.
Your path to financial freedom starts now.
Starts now.
All right, folks, welcome to Investing for Beginners podcast. Today, we have a very special guest. Today, we are excited to have Ali join us. Ali is a longtime listener of the podcast, and he's newer to investing. He started officially investing in 2021. So this is going to be a fun conversation. We're going to talk about a lot of different things. So Ali, welcome to the show. Thank you very much for taking time out of your busy day as a doctor to come talk to us. And we're looking forward to this. So I guess maybe give us a brief introduction to you, and maybe start telling us a little bit about how you got here and how you started your investing journey.
Yeah, good morning. Thank you guys for having me. It's really a pleasure to finally be here. So yeah, I guess we could start in when I moved to the US. I'm originally from Lebanon. I moved to the US in 2019. I've always had some interest in investing and all that finance stuff. So I started listening to the podcast mostly in 2019, at the end of 2019. And it was a lot of episodes to catch on, but then I've been like still listening weekly since then. It took me a while before, you know, having some soul in the game or like skin in the game and starting putting some money due to like personal reasons, but mostly to build up the emergency fund, all these stuff that you need to have a good base before you start investing. After that, I, you know, as you said, in 2021, I moved to my new job. I had a clear fixed income for the foreseeable future. So I decided to start to open a Roth and start putting money in there. And that's how it all started. I started mostly putting money based on the letter but also some in ETFs. It depends really on how much extra money I have done or not, but mainly through the Roth IRA. After that, you know, I started expanding a bit, trying different stuff like ETFs, bond, mostly ETFs before bonds. Ever since, I've been trying to max out my Roth. And then after that, I moved on to my company. My employer started offering matching for 403B. And so I started using that, trying to max on that as well, because it's free money. That's really, in short, my investing journey. And we can talk about all the details about like the distribution, the different weights I use. It's really nothing. It's really personalized. So I don't think there's a hard science for that.
I agree with you. I haven't found it to be a hard science on my side either. Maybe we could start on the weighting. What does your weighting look like? How do you, have like a target you try to put for the portfolio, or has it kind of just organically happened?
I think it's a really mix of both. The letter is based on a 150 per month model. And for the Roth now, at least this year, you can put 550 per month. So there's a marginal difference. Now, that doesn't mean that the picks are only 20 or 30% of the portfolio. It's actually like quite the opposite. I think the picks are 60 to 70%. And then the 30% are in either just money, like government funds waiting to be invested, or in ETFs. I mainly use like the VOO, the VTV, and the VTI. So it's really a mix of both. I did not feel there's a major difference between all of them. And some in international funds. It's really, I don't know the utility of international funds at this point. I feel like I have different ones, like one that's focused on Asia, like Pacific, one that's really India-based, and the one in Europe. But really, in this time of hyper-globalization, everything is connected. A lot of things are being owned by the same big venture, like venture cap companies and stuff. So I don't know. Like, they all trend really the same way to an extent. I don't know if it's going to make any difference on the long term or not, whether you're bullish or bearish on a certain country. I don't know if that's going to really matter. So I would say the weights are like 60 and then 30% in ETFs. And of course, like one share of Berkshire, because all investors should own it.
Yes. Yeah, 100%. You have plans to go to any other annual meetings?
I definitely plan to. I don't know. It's definitely going to be in the next 3 years. Still not sure when.
Mm. Nice. Well, hit us up. I mean, you might see us there. I haven't had a chance to go in a while, but I've been itching to go again.
Yeah, I need to go. It's got to be on my to-do list for this coming year.
Yeah. So, you know, you look at a company like Berkshire, and it's almost like they have their own portfolio, and, you know, they're diversified through different industries. So when we're talking about the 60% of your Roth that's in the picks that I do for Value Spotlight, how do you split those up when you're shaping a portfolio?
Regarding the 60%, when I started, some of the picks were already made in the portfolio. I really don't look at these stuff because, you know, there was a specific time that these were bought. It doesn't mean that they're still a good pick per se. But ever since I joined, I tend to mostly go with whatever the pick is, bar a few examples that I can't really, either for ethical or job-related reasons, I can't really invest in them. Beyond these, I just go with the pick. If I feel, you know, specific affinity to a company, I might put a bit more into that, or I feel like I see that I have a specific amount of cash, more than I have, I might put more into that. Or let's say we have a lot of, let's say I like REITs. Like if the pick is a REIT or something, I might just put more money into that. I tend to like the concept of REITs, or like fixed income, or like companies giving back a lot of dividends. So that's why, for example, I like these. So I might tend to put like money more into these picks or not. And that's really how I've been doing it.
Nice. Oh, yeah, I like that. It sounds like it's flexible and you're willing to adjust to what the conditions are for not only yourself, but also what's in the market.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, some of the picks may, I feel, have a bigger role in the upcoming, let's say, short term or long term, in terms of like the country, like maybe home building or appliances or whatever, more than, or like, let's say, AI or chips or whatever as well. These, I feel like they have a bigger future than maybe some of the staple kind of things. although all of them will have a role in my portfolio, just in a different way kind of thing.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. So I guess, how do you see the portfolio moving forward? Do you think you're going to kind of try to keep it at that kind of mixture of individual stocks and more ETFs? Or how do you see that evolving? Or do you see that evolving?
Well, hopefully it just keeps going up. But beyond that, I don't really have a specific feel on how it's going. I think I'm going to stay in that range of 60 to 40, like 60 single picks and 40 ETFs. I do not have any plans of incorporating bonds at this point, you know, in terms of fixed income and stuff, just given how the job usually is in terms of a resident physician, then moving on to fellowship or like an attending physician. There's just a big difference in terms of income. And then I use that extra income maybe to build the bonds or like the fixed stream later on, but nothing really currently. Like, I don't foresee anything like bonds or for the next 20, 30 years. But focusing on this, just let's say the Roth IRA, I think it's going to remain more or less the same, depending really on opportunities. Maybe at some point, I don't feel like I want to do a lot of picks anymore, I might tone down a bit and increase the ETFs a bit more, or maybe the opposite. Wow, there's a company I really like, I'm just going to keep piling money into it, and then it's going to grow exponentially and inflate that portfolio.
So you can obviously correct me if I'm wrong. We've been chatting to you for what, like half hour, but you do strike me as somebody who has a good sense of risk management. Like, you seem to have a good dialed in sense of your risk tolerance. Where do you think that stems from?
Absolutely. Like, I'm very risk averse, although I'm just learning more and more now about, you know, what it means to take a risk, how to try and quantify it. You know, all the good books come into mind, like the Black Swan, all these stuff. I'm just getting now into these stuff. I think this really stems from like my background, middle class, like frugal childhood, building myself up, moving all the way here to the US and trying to build a new life for myself, and like being immersed in this world of hyper resources for everything. And I mean, if you're here, you can make yourself, you just gotta have the right mindset and right attitude to an extent.
I think you definitely do have that right mindset and right outlook. I applaud you for everything you're doing. I wish I had had that same fortitude and resolve when I was your age.
Thank you.
Do you feel like as you've continued to invest in the stock market, do you feel like some of that appetite to take risk has maybe increased as you've gotten more comfortable? Or do you feel that you like the risk tolerance you have now and you see that continuing for the future?
Yeah, I mean, when I mentioned like that in some certain points, I did take a risk. For example, like, so I remember being on vacation in Miami with like my friends, and it was that episode when Musk was going to come on like Saturday night and talk about Dogecoin. And then, all right, boys, what are we doing? Beach and putting money in Dogecoin. And then we put like whatever expenses, like certain expendable income we had, or at least I did. I don't know about them, but So like we parked. I mean, I put, I think, at least $500 in there, and, you know, I just saw it go up and then down. And so it's fine to take some risks from time to time with the expendable income that you know for sure you're going to lose. But if you win, or if you have like a great return from it, that's great, but don't really count on it. I'm sorry, what was the question?
Just curious if your risk appetite has changed, like from day one, being a beginner, not really necessarily having the experience to know what kind of investor you want to be versus today.
Yeah, I feel like my risk appetite has more or less remained the same in terms of my focus is still to build a very good base for myself and build a solid base that I can count on in the future when I retire. And then after that, I can start thinking about, you know, taking more risky investments or these kind of stuff.
So you've mentioned REITs, which if you're a beginner, that's a real estate investment trust. It has much higher dividends than the usual stock. You also mentioned liking bonds, or at least being attracted to the idea of that steady income stream. So what is it about like a steady income stream for somebody who's a beginner? hasn't been an investor, doesn't even know this is possible, what is it about a steady income stream that's appealing to you?
It's simply because it's 100%, it's going to be yours. Like, you can count on this income over the next year or over the next 5 years. Like, if you put money in a CD for five years and then get, you know, you're going to get that money at the end of the road plus whatever they promised you. Same thing for bonds. I'm also like a big fan, at least at this point, of searching every few months for like saving accounts or like checking with a good bonus, just because if you calculate these returns for the bonus, you can get like a 10% APR for that certain year just by parking your money there as opposed to keeping it where it is. So just focusing on these stuff, you can make an extra money that you can either splurge on yourself or like just put more into the stock market, whichever you prefer.
What's the best way to get started in the market? Download Andrew's ebook for free at stockmarketpdf.com.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
To start that like snowball effect, right? Where every year you get a little bit more. You would mention, you know, certain picks that you might like that you would put more money into. And, you know, feel free, you can mention any of them that have been in Value Spotlight. I don't mind. But okay, when you say, when I like a pick more, what does that mean to you? Is it metrics-based, quantitative? Is it something more qualitative? How do you determine that for yourself?
Unfortunately, it's not really metrics-based. Unfortunately or unfortunately, I'll leave that up to you guys. But in terms of, and I don't want to like use this term vibes because it's such a such an oversold term at this point. But just thinking about it, like, let's say the Texas Instruments, for example, I really feel like the company has a good outlook just based on how things are geopolitically, in terms of the amount of use that we need for these stuff. Now, of course, it's up to them if they make use of all these proper like environment for them to grow or not. But that's why we rely on metrics. But based on that, while, for example, the similar company like the TSM Taiwan Semiconductors, I was a bit hesitant just because of the way things are over there. I may or may not understand the situation well over there, but it's really way above my pay grade to know what's going to happen there. Like, it's a lot of classified information, a lot of things that we do not have simply control on. So maybe I prefer, and that's why I like to mostly invest in U.S. companies as well. A similar maybe like stuff. No, I wouldn't go really into banking a lot. I do not understand that. That's why we have Dave. But I mean, yeah, this is the main example, I would say. You know, we have a lot of examples also for, even if you have a good outlook or a good feeling about the company, it might turn to be not a bad investment, but a disappointing one. You know, most recently Target was not that, what's really disappointing either, although like I did not look way deep into it, but it could be a mixture of actual finances, but also like whatever recent controversy they found themselves in. So,
yeah, I feel like you have good insight into the process. You know, it is about building a portfolio, and as much as we can fall in love with one company or the other, the future is uncertain. So that's why we have to diversify.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, diversification is king, not only in a portfolio and how you put your money and really in everything like in life, but specifically like stock finances, like diversification everywhere, in ETFs, diversify, in picks, diversify, in different modes, diversify, in different money, like money operating. Like, let's say you have some in a Roth IRA, but also you want to put some stuff in that, like, recently, I had to make a decision whether to put some of the money in I get from, you know, from my company or from my employer in a Roth 403b versus a regular one. And I read a lot of articles, which one do they recommend? And, you know, each person has different opinion. And then I fell back on one rule, I just diversify. So I put them in everything, that I have everything in Roth now. I'll just put them in a regular one. Whatever happens in the future in terms of a tax code changes or like in an income stream, I'll be set for it because I'm diversified.
Yeah, love that. Do you want to talk about your international exposure? You mentioned some ETFs. It'd be fun to dive into some of that. And
yeah, absolutely.
So you mentioned the different areas that you're kind of putting money into. I think you mentioned Asia, Europe, and there was another one I can't remember. India. So how did you... Thank you, India.
Yep.
How did you come to those? What was the driving force behind that decision as well?
The decision that really, I mean, listening to different podcasts or reading different articles online and stuff, I wanted to see what that kind of exposure is. And some of the really big companies internationally, surprising, you know, to know that, but there are good companies outside the US.
Yes.
So I decided to look into that. And that's why I fell onto these different areas. And I read like about all different areas. Like I read about South America, about different kind of ETFs, let that include, I think, China or not. And I mean, you can know because some of them have like, they have the name and then EX China or EX US means without the US. And that's how I look. I try to compare them, but it really falls always down to two things for me, the expense ratio and the which company holdings do they have. If they have 99% in one company, like in Japan, not sure which company, maybe it's Samsung or something like that. If they have 99%, then might as well just go invest in that company if you want. So also go back to, like, they need to have a good diversification in that company. And then you just read like, you know, how the situation is there. Like, for example, I don't like investing in China specifically just because of how the political structure is there and how, like, we really can't know a lot of information from there. So I just stay away from that. I don't want to park my money over there. Some people might have the appetite for that risk, but they can do that. I'm investigating, you know, India. So there's an ETF, Franklin something. I use that. And there's one in Europe. I actually have them in front of me. But like it's the Vanguard one. So you have the VGK and the VPL. The VPL is the Pacific one and the VGK is the European one. And why I focus on the expense ratio is because, you know, I think it's a loss just from the get-go. Although it's a small loss, but like some of them might charge you 1.5% as opposed to 0.2%. So that's like a 1% per annually that you're not going to see just based on that.
It adds up.
But to go back to one thing we mentioned, I don't understand or I don't believe in the utility of investing internationally in this kind of world that we live in currently. I feel like all the companies are connected. It's really hyper-globalized. And I don't think we understand yet all the de-dollarization, all these kind of stuff that people talk about. I don't think we understand yet how these are going to affect the international markets. So it might actually make them more independent, and then it's important to invest internationally if you want, but it also might mean that they all go down or up at the same time. So might as well make it easier for yourself and put your money here in VTI or something like that. So, I mean, only time will tell. I doubt anyone really has a really good answer for this.
I mean, people have their own opinions. They love to spout it.
Yeah.
I mean, for me personally, I'd be curious what your guys' thoughts are. I just feel like picking a ship and sticking to it for the most part, you know, being somebody who buys a lot of U.S. stocks, that doesn't mean I'm not getting exposure to the other countries. You look at a company like Microsoft, more than half of their revenue or about half of their revenue comes from abroad. But you always run that risk that, like China was in the 90s or other countries that have had growth spurts, you can totally miss out on that growth. The question is, what's the trade-off of, do I want to play that currency game? Do I want to play the world economic game, or do I want to stick to a circle of competence? Mm-hmm. Dave, how do you kind of think of that?
That's a good question. I think I try to stick with my circle of competence, but I won't lie and say that I do come across companies like Agen or Topicus, which are both in Europe, that I fall in love with and I decide to buy. But the same token, I own Visa, which is a global country, and they do half of their revenues, if not more. Well, maybe not quite half, but they do quite a bit of revenue outside of the United States. And so it's an international company. And so I know that I was reading Netflix's 10K the other day, and I think they only do about 30 or 40% of their revenue in the United States. The rest of it's global. And so, you know, when you invest in a company like that or Google, you invest in those companies, you are investing internationally because they have quite a bit of exposure to outside of the United States. And so you do get a mixture of that. So you can, I mean, you can go, you know, hog wild and just, you know, invest outside of the United States and, you know, kind of do like Ali's doing, or even doing a little bit like I'm doing, or you can go nuts and just buy companies and just all in LATAM and be done with it. But I think I try to stay more in the United States and get that exposure through the companies that I'm doing in the United States, because it's my circle of competence. And I don't, you know, I've been to Brazil, but I haven't lived there. I know nothing about Argentina. I know nothing about Colombia. Mm-hmm. And for me trying to invest in those, I feel like would be outside of my circle. Same with India. I've never been there and I'd love to invest in it at some point, but I just haven't pulled the trigger yet because I don't know what I don't know. And I feel like it's easier to, I guess, keep my home bias and invest here in the United States.
Yeah, no, I agree. And just to be clear, like, for example, I have my exposure to international stuff, at least direct companies, is like 10% in my portfolio. And I don't think there are plans to make it any bigger. And like going back to India specifically, you hear a lot recently about Apple trying to shift all their production to over there or diversify in that region, et cetera, et cetera. But you also read other articles at the same time mentioning how their way of their country or like their way of economy is not going to last, or like at least it's not going to be sustainable, et cetera, et cetera. So we simply do not know. And the regulations over there are not things as we understand as well as we understand the regulations here. So might as well play it safe. If you actually want to be very safe, then maybe it's easier to put all your money there. And that's why, just as I experimented with bonds for a short time, for like 3 years, I'm now experimenting with international stuff. Doesn't mean I'm going to stay in it for long. Maybe as I invest more in U.S. companies, this 10% will shrink and become 2% in like 5-10 years.
I would like to see more international companies that would trade on the NYSE or the NASDAQ. I mean, I was looking at a company yesterday, huge presence, just diversified throughout many end markets related to building products. But they traded in Paris. So you can't buy stocks traded in Paris in a retirement account, at least not with Fidelity. So it would be nice to see some of that. And, you know, nothing of this is static. And that's what I appreciate about your answer, Ali. You say, what I'm doing now can change depending on how the world changes. And for all we know, we're going to be listening to this 5 years later. Dave and I are going to be like, yeah, you're not doing that anymore. So it all depends on what happens in the world, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Do you have a long-term mindset searching for safe compounders? So am I. And I'm investing my entire life savings with the picks from ValueSpotlight.com.
And I mean, it goes back to someone, you guys actually introduced me to him, Vitaly, and his all-weather portfolio and all this stuff that he does. And I mean, I think it's really important to try and get to that all-weather portfolio, because we simply do not know what's going to happen in the future, given all the different stuff that happen all the time around us. So it's really, what's even harder than that is getting that portfolio, but also positioning it well to grow in a way that will give you enough revenue whenever you want to use that money to retire or whatever you want to do.
Yeah, I love that you brought it back to the basics of, you know, what are these investments even trying to do for us? And to your point, we want to have income, especially in retirement. So Ali, what does financial freedom mean to you? If you could try to Obviously a tough question, but what would that mean for you?
That would mean to me, I mean, given how my job is and what the future looks like, that either means to me that early retirement or like early for doctors means 60s probably, but like early retirement and simply relying on that money to live, being able to be completely independent. Like in the future, I will have opportunities to work, let's say, one day a week and make enough income just that, because of the type of job. But let's say I don't want to work, and that really means financial independence. And not only then, also now, although granted, it's very hard now to be financially independent, of course. But really focusing on the future and simply being able to live your life, maximize doing whatever you want to do without worrying about your finances.
Yes. Yeah, that's a great answer. I really like that. Yeah, I really like those answers. And I feel like you have a good sense of where you're trying to go with your financial future. And I think that's important. If you're a beginner, it doesn't mean you have to have it all figured out today, but over time, hopefully, as you learn about investing, you start to get a sense of what you're trying to do, and that helps you become a better investor and a better investor for yourself. So I guess, Ali, do you have questions around what the end of that journey looks like, or even anything in between? I take from our conversation today, you're in that accumulation phase. You know, at a certain point, hopefully, all of us are going to hit that harvesting phase. But what does that look like for you in that transition? Did you have anything that you were curious about along that path?
Mm-hmm. I think one thing that I tried to experiment in previously, but then stopped, which is bonds, really, and thinking about how to incorporate bonds towards the end of the portfolio, especially when you start, when you have to start relying on this income to actually live. You know, you hear a lot these days about bonds, sell up, bond sell off, rates going up. And to me, as a beginner, it doesn't make sense. Like, if the rates are going up, why are people selling off? Are they moving their money to different investments that can make them more money? Or what's the deal there? And when would be like a good time to start moving? Would it be 5 years before your retirement, or just at 65? Or if you have any thoughts, maybe.
Well, those are some big questions. So I guess let's start with, like, when would you want to start looking at bonds? Some of it's going to go back to the personal part of personal finance and how, where you are in your journey and how risk averse you are. Generally, bonds are safer than stocks or equities, but not always. And there's, as you have learned in your short time in the market, there's nothing absolute. And so there's that kind of part to think about. So let's say you're 50, you're 10, 15, 20 years away from retirement, depending on where you are. That is probably, I guess, the generally accepted time to start considering moving some of your portfolio into more of a fixed income status. And I'm not saying going from 100% to 50%, but maybe like 100% to maybe like 15 or 20% of fixed income, whether it's bonds, whether it's savings accounts, whether it's money market accounts, whatever is going to earn you the best return that allows you to still sleep at night. And as you get closer to that retirement age, it starts to shift to 50-50, maybe 40-60, 30-70. Really, again, it really comes back to your risk tolerance. And the other thing we have to think about too is we're all living longer now. And so the standard that maybe our parents and our grandparents lived by is different than we are. My generation, and you guys are younger, so your generation will be, you know, even different. You know, by the time you guys are my age, you guys might live forever. I don't know, you know, with all the advancements they have in medicine, right? So, but having said that, the kind of the best way to think about bonds for the people that are like, what the heck are they talking about? Bonds is basically it's a fixed income asset that you can buy that is the debt of another company. So they're selling you the debt. When you think about investing in, let's use Microsoft, the company everybody knows, it's very familiar. You can buy the stock, which is the equity that you trade on the stock market, but you can also buy the debt. So Microsoft will sell debt to people, they'll say to me, hey, Dave, if you give me $100 that I can use to go invest in whatever I want, then I'm going to give you a dividend. They call it, it can be a coupon or dividend. They'll pay you a fixed amount of that money. And then you get your $100 back at the end of whatever the contract is. Typically, it's 10 to 30 years, depending. And so that fixed income, you know you're going to get your money back. And you also know that you're going to earn some small income as the company continues to hold your money and use it to invest. And so when you buy those are generally safer than buying the equity of Microsoft, but not always. Some of it will depend on the company and what kind of debt you're talking about. Without getting all the nitty gritty of everything, you're kind of asking, like, why would people want to buy bonds now versus before? And a big part of it is the interest rates. So the interest rates right now are hovering around 5%, and that's for the 10-year treasury bond, which means that if you buy treasury bonds for 5%, you get 5% return guaranteed from the government, which is the strongest financial instrument, one of the strongest financial instruments you can buy. And some people will look at that and go, well, that's risk-free. I'm not going to lose money on that. And 5% return is really, really good. And in most cases, that's better than almost any savings account you can find. And so people will flock to that thinking, hey, I can earn 5% without any risk. I don't have to worry about buying Tesla and worrying about it dropping 22% in the next week and a half. I can just buy a T-bill and go, oh, okay, great. So that's part of why there's a big flocking to those recently as the rates have gone up. The other reason that you're seeing this big sell-off in bonds right now is because a lot of people are selling the bonds they have to buy ones that have a better yield. So when you buy a bond, you kind of have a contract. And so if you have a 10-year bond and it's only giving you 2.5%, which is what the rates were a year ago, you could sell that and buy a new one and get a 5% rate. So it's higher. And so there's that too. And the way the bonds work is it's set at $100 and you get a certain percent of a dividend. Let's say you get $2 of a dividend. As the price of the stock falls, that dividend goes up. The actual dollar amount doesn't go up, but the return that you would get would go up. And it's kind of works like a seesaw. So as the prices of the bonds go up, the yield, the return that you would get on that bond falls. And when there's a big sell-off on bonds, that means the prices go down. And that means that the yields go up, and that makes them more attractive for people to rush in and try to buy those air quote cheaper bonds. And mm-hmm. That's where the inflows and the outflows of the bond market comes from. And that's why people look at those as an opportunity to buy them. Now, it all sounds great in theory. The challenge with bonds is that it's really, really hard to buy them as an individual investor. So us, you know, the three of us here, we got to come up with 100K or more to buy one. And so most people, you look at looking using bond ETF funds as a way to work in the bond market, and you can do that. And that's great. It's not an area I play in. I did a little bit and I learned enough to know that I don't know enough. And then I kind of got out. And so it's not really an area I play much in. But that's why, I guess in a nutshell, what bonds are, why people are flocking to them right now. So does that help a little bit?
Yeah, no, that's super helpful. And going back to the last point, that was exactly what was my next question, which is, I also did a bit in the bond ETFs. And this is what I learned, essentially, that I don't know enough. But also, any idea why, you know, when you use the government website, which, I mean, a lot of people have very strong emotions about, you put, like, let's say I used it to buy the I-bonds whenever they were giving the 9%. Mm-hmm. So I also played with that a bit to add to my story, but I used it for that. I know it can be used to buy just government bonds providing the 5% you just mentioned, but let's say you put $5,000 in there. When you enter the website, you still see it as a $5,000 and you know you're going to get the 5% at the end, let's say. But if you buy the ETF, for example, when I did, by the time I sold it, it was negative 40%, let's say, with the income that I was getting every month or every quarter from that bond. So by the end, I'm not actually getting even my money. I'm But is it like if I have waited 10 years for it to quote unquote mature, then it would flow back in there? Or how would you like reconcile these stuff?
Without getting super, super technical, my understanding is that the way the bond funds works is they buy bonds on different maturity levels. And so they buy a bond that's got a 10-year maturity level and it drops, then it has 10 years to mature. But if they buy bonds that are shorter in duration and are going to, and they drop, they don't have as long to recover. And so that's kind of my understanding. Again, I'm not an expert in bond ETFs, so don't take that for what it's worth. But I remember reading some early on that was kind of how they would play the market, was that they would buy varying ranges of durations of bonds to help mitigate that risk of the fund falling that much. But yeah, I had the same issue. I had the bond fund that dropped like 30-40%, and I was like, okay, yeah, we got to get out of this.
Yeah.
No, I think this is one of the tragedies of the last 5 years that's just not being talked about all that much. This whole bond discussion, we just recorded an episode on it, and we're going to try to answer your questions here. Ali probably does fall a little bit outside of our circle of competence, so I would recommend talking to a financial advisor. I would say when you're asking about why the ETFs are falling in value, we have to remember that you have a bond, which again, if you bought one, it would do a certain thing for you. The ETFs are buying baskets of bonds. So let's take like a 10-year treasury and say it's an ETF that buys 10-year treasuries. So this means that they are buying, I don't know, 100, 1,000, however many treasuries per day that they're buying. If I have treasury, and they're holding them to maturity, right? But if I'm buying, if I bought a 10-year today and then it fell in price in a year, but I still have that 10-year on the balance sheet, then the value of that fell. So even though I'm getting the coupons on it, what that bond is worth is less. And like Dave said, it's on the seesaw. So when you see interest rates going up, that means that less people are buying the bonds. And when we say people, we don't mean retail people like you and I. This is a multi-trillion-dollar market, and we're talking about banks, sovereign wealth funds, all these sort of big financial institutions that are either buying or not buying the bonds. And that causes the prices to go up or down, and it causes the yields, the effective yields, to go up or down. And so I think that's why it can make it so confusing, because I mean, we're guilty of it just like anybody else. We try to simplify to try to explain what's going on. That doesn't really tell the whole picture because the bond market's massive. So to go back to your question, why did a bond ETF fall? Some of it could be what Dave's saying, where they're buying different maturities. Some of it too is just simply for the fact that they're buying baskets of bonds. They're not buying one bond. So we have to separate the thinking from one bond in time versus they're buying baskets maybe every day or whatever their frequency is. And so if they have bonds that they're holding, but the price of those bonds has gone down, then that value of that ETF has gone down.
No, I think some of this makes sense, of course. But I think if you're not a full-time, or this is your not job full-time, like to invest or to like diversify and do all that stuff, then maybe you need to say, all right, this will take too much effort and I need to rely either on a specialist or a tax or like an accountant, or I'm just going to not do it. I mean, sometimes I just think that Apple or Berkshire or Microsoft are so big that they can actually act as a very stable place to just put your money and rely on them for the next 30, 40 years to give you money. So why even bother with this headache of thinking about bonds and these kind of stuff?
Yeah, and that's going to be a question that's personal to everybody. I guess my take on it, since I haven't shared yet, is Brian Feraldi had a really great graphic that he shared on Twitter where he talked about the probabilities of making a profit in the stock market and how if you look at one day, your probability is close to 50-50. But if you zoom out over 20 years, every 20-year period we've ever had in the stock market, if you bought and then in 20 years looked at what you bought, you've made money on that deal. When we talk about bonds in the context of what's happened over the last 3 years, and particularly when interest rates have gone crazy, that's a very special time. Over the lifetime of an investor, that's usually not going to happen. We talk about bonds like it's this isolated thing. Stocks, a lot of stocks multiples have come down too, quite a bit, and probably as much as bonds have, if not more, because usually they would fall more than bonds. We're just seeing a really weird time in the stock market where you have the Magnificent Seven stocks that are driving the whole index, right? Mm-hmm. So when I look at a certain point when you're so late in the accumulation phase that you're starting to look at harvesting, I think the hassle and the complexities around having bonds in your portfolio becomes worth looking into, because historically over many, many decades, bonds have been that safe haven of shelter mm-hmm. for investors, because like Dave said in the beginning, they are contractually obligated to pay you that money. Whereas a stock, somebody could cut the dividend tomorrow. And so because of that risk reward, that's why I like your approach, Ali. I mean, somebody like Apple or Microsoft or Berkshire has way less complexity and has a nice long time horizon because they're such strong businesses. And they do generally make more return than a bond would, but the bonds have their place for high net worth, ultra high net worth who don't need to accumulate, and people who are harvesting at the end of their retirement. And so when you add that plus the fact that you do have taxes and all of that, I think it does make sense to have a professional help you with that. But again, we're talking about being close to that harvesting stage and where is that risk tolerance, and how much, you know, somebody has a $20,000 portfolio, maybe it's not worth it, but if it's significantly higher and they're looking to start to harvest it, I think the bigger that becomes, the more value you could probably get from a financial advisor who can also get you resources to help you with taxes. Because yeah, when you sell investments, there are taxes too, unless you have everything in the Roth. So that's a lot of factors, but hopefully that's somewhat helpful in showing what the future could hold.
I agree. And of course, you know, long-term thinking, you also have to think like, companies, Apple, Microsoft, they're open to liabilities, antitrust, all these stuff that we don't, like this country goes from one side to another in terms of thinking about antitrust during the years. So you don't know in 50 years how things are going to be. So you can't really open yourself to all these stuff just by relying on one company to make you money when you actually need it the most, which is retirement.
100%.
But like in the short term, like let's say now, T-bills are also being talked about. How would you park whatever money? Like we know we're not like talking Buffett level, but he has billions just being parked in government funds. But for someone that's a really beginner who has, let's say, a couple of thousand on the side or like whatever disposable income that's on the side, where would you think we best, like, first, is there any difference between what's called like a government money fund or the SPACs, Fidelity, which is the default they place the money, or actually putting them in something called the treasury bill ETF? And the second question is, would you even bother versus just putting them in a savings?
Well, I think it really kind of comes down again to your personal choice. So let's say, hate to keep going back to that, but
easy option first, please.
Right. Yeah. So let's say you have $2,000. I guess the first question I would ask myself would be, how liquid do I need this to be? So in other words, how quickly do I need to be able to access this? If I'm like, okay, I'm comfortable socking this away for the next 5 years, then to me, it would be a no-brainer and put it in a T-bill and be done with it. If I was like, I think I need to keep like $1,000 around for whatever reason, then I would start looking for savings accounts, short-term CDs, maybe a money market account that would pay me a decent return, and put that $1,000 in those, maybe a combination of those or just one of them, and then put the $1,000 in the T-bill. If I want all of it to be liquid, if like, in other words, if I need to access it tomorrow, then I would put all of it in a savings account or a money market account that I can withdraw immediately, simply for the fact that you're going to get a decent return. I know that I bank with Ally Bank, and I think they're around 4-4.5% on savings accounts right now, which isn't awesome, but it's a heck of a lot better than a lot of other banks. So, you know, that, and if I need it, that makes me feel better. If you're saving money to buy a house, do not put it in this, in the stock market. Do not put it in the stock market. Put it somewhere safe, like a savings account or a CD, and just be okay with earning 3% and just moving on with your day. There are bigger fish to fry, but that's how I would approach it. I guess, did you have any thoughts on that, Andrew, or is there anything, Ali, that you wanted to comment on?
I just wanted to be clear that I was talking about money that's parked there for investing in the future and not like for personal finances.
Yep.
I just do all the finances on the side, and whatever right. money I have, I do the investing. So for money that's really set aside for investing purposes, where would you think it would be a good idea to park them, and what? And is there any difference between like government funds versus T-bills versus, we're not going to go back to bonds, so let's not talk about that.
Right. I guess for my money's worth, again, it goes back to the liquidity and how long you're intending for that money to sit there. So if you're intending it to sit there for a really long time, I think the thing with the T-bills is it is liquid. You can get it back. It just takes a few days to work with the government website to get the money transferred back to you. So it's not as fast as a savings account, or it's not as fast as putting it in the money market fund that Fidelity holds your money in. To my knowledge, the money market fund that the Fidelity holds the money in, I don't think it gives you much of anything of a return. So basically, like most checking accounts, it's just kind of there. So it kind of comes back to how quickly do you need the money, and how long do you intend, or do you think you're going to have that money sit someplace before you put it in the market? If it's only going to be there for 3 weeks until Andrew's next pick, then I would just leave it in the SPAC and not even worry about it. You got bigger fish to fry. But if it's going to be there longer than that, then I would look around for other options. That Fidelity has savings accounts. I don't know what their returns are. I don't know what their rates are, but that would be an option. Or looking at, again, T-bills or some sort of, you know, money market fund, I think would be liquid enough. Andrew, what are your thoughts on my crazy ideas?
We're not crazy. I think when people talk about like Buffett's in T-bills or Buffett's buying bonds, we have to remember that they have many insurance subsidiaries. And so if he's buying T-bills, that doesn't mean he's keeping them as fresh powder. Mm-hmm. He could be buying them to keep enough reserves for the insurance and all the complexities that go into that accounting. And so what he's doing is different. If a hedge fund's talking about it too, they could have certain, like if it's an all-weather fund and they're trying to always keep 20% in cash, that might make sense to put in T-bills also, because you can get that allocation that they're always looking for. But if you buy T-bills, you do run the risk of it going down in value, because if I'm buying a T-bill today, let's say I'm buying a T-bill in a month and T-bills are earning 6% yield. Why would I buy Dave's T-bill that he bought a week ago that's only earning 5% when I can buy a new one at 6%? Right. And so that's why Dave's T-bill would go down. And so to your point about having bigger fish to fry, if you keep it in cash, the benefit is if Berkshire goes down 20% overnight,
you can buy it tomorrow.
You can just take that and you're going to earn 20%, assuming you got a 20% discount what its long-term value is worth. So I think when we're talking about the T-bills, I think it's a great question. I think it's super fascinating, especially with all the movements we've seen the last several years. Mm-hmm. But if you put it back to that bigger fish to fry, plus you are taking on capital risk, price appreciation risk, I think it also makes sense to just keep it in cash and have it ready whenever you want to pounce.
So it's similar to the bonds, but on a much shorter or like short-term scale. And I was just checking like the Fidelity government money market. They say that the 7-day yield is 5%. I don't know if that means that they actually give you that like per year, of course, 5% if you keep that money in there or not. But I mean, just keep it there. It seems to make more sense until the next pick or until your next investment.
Yeah, I don't want to speak for them, but I'm assuming they are recycling those like crazy in order to keep it similar to cash.
Right.
But that yield would probably go down if we saw the Fed start to cut rates. And so that yield is not static. But absolutely. neither is your yield in your savings account. So this is just the lovely part of the game that we all play.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's why, I mean, most of your income or most of your inflow will be from stocks, from long-term investing in stocks.
Right.
Yeah, 100%. Right.
Yeah, 100%. I think the thing that I would come back to is, I know there's always the pressure to try to optimize, but I guess the thing to keep in mind is, you know, to what extent do you want to spend your time trying to optimize a potential money that you're going to invest, or would you rather spend time optimizing the pick you're going to make that's going to make you more? And, you know, we all have a finite amount of time to do all these things. And if you're spending all of your time trying to figure out how to earn an extra $3 or $4 versus, trying to figure out where is it best to put my money in, you know, in this pick for Andrew or the one he did 2 months ago that I think has got an even better return, I would rather spend my time trying to figure that out than trying to make an extra $3. But that's just the way I'm wired.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, you actually reminded me of something I forgot to mention, is that when I put the 550 in the Roth, not only I do the monthly pick, but I also look to see which of the recent, not like 2 or 3 years ago, but recent, like more like in the past few months, that are still in a similar price range that I feel good about, and I put more in there.
Yep.
So that's one thing I also do.
Yep, I do the same thing.
Yeah, that's awesome. Well, Ollie, we really appreciate your time. I want to thank you personally for being a member of Value Spotlight. And it's great to have you on the show. And this was a great conversation to go back and forth with bonds. I know it's an endlessly confusing topic, so hopefully we answered a couple questions there.
Yeah, no, thank you so much. It's really a pleasure to be here. And all the recent changes on Value Spotlight, giving us more insight and more topics to think about. Like before, it was more on a monthly basis. Now it's multiple times a week and keeping us engaged. It's really a pleasure to be part of this community.
Thank you.
Awesome. Well, Ali, I wanted to thank you as well. I really appreciate you taking time out of your day. I know you had your day off today, but I know you work hard. So we appreciate you spending some of your free time with us. We learned a lot, and hopefully you learned a thing or two as well. And we appreciate your time. And with that, I will go ahead and sign us off. You guys go out there and invest with a margin of safety, emphasis on the safety. Have a great week, and we'll talk to y'all next week.
We hope you enjoyed this content. 7 Steps to Understanding the Stock Market shows you precisely how to break down the numbers in an engaging and readable way with real-life examples. Get access today at stockmarketpdf.com. Until next time, have a prosperous day.
The information contained is for general information and educational purposes only. It is not intended for a substitute for legal, commercial, and/or financial advice from a licensed professional. Review our full disclaimer at einvestingforbeginners.com.